delighted to introduce this workshop on drug targets. Understanding diseases at the molecular level is very exciting. We're living through a very exciting time. The human genome, as you know, was decoded at the turn of the millennium just 5 years ago. And the medical research, the industrial ecosystem, and the practice was forever changed. And we're going to try to give you a glimpse on how. The genome of an organism is a two-dimensional and static description of a living creature and symbolized by the molecular construct on the left here. But to come to life, it needs to be translated into action, just like a screenplay needs to be turned into acting. And you can see in the right-hand side a picture of a cell where some of these genes have been translated into proteins, and these proteins have been highlighted. We call that labeled. And you can see some of the proteins that are tubulin, that are helpful for the cytoskeleton, or the actins and other membrane proteins. This is how we can start highlighting the actors of this screenplay, which is the very first step in the understanding. Now, a few years ago, actually not too long ago, the interaction between all the proteins in the yeast, which is a microorganism that is the simplest microorganism close to our cells, the interactions between all these proteins were decoded. And this is the map that you see on the left. It's called the yeast proteome. And the interaction between those is called the interactomes. So just like in health and in disease, the result of the protein interacting is with many proteins is called pathways. And understanding these pathways, or what we call elucidating these pathways, is the beginning of the new quest of after the decoding of the genome. Now, when things go wrong between these interactions, these malfunctions, disease happen. So the new challenge is for us to understand that, and this will lead to the new discovery, the discovery of new targets and better and safer drugs. Now, what we call targets in this context is actually protein. And when we have a drug that interacts with a protein, it changes the function of this protein, and in this case, it may change the way it interacts with another protein, which is the way you address the pathways and the diseases. So there's a ton to explore. Now, how did this happen? That happens basically through a very, very elaborate network of a lot of institutions, but that can be categorized into three categories. At the top, where basic research happens, is academic and medical institutions. And like a prestigious institution like this one, where a number of experiments and fundamental research is conducted to understand the molecular interaction. Then there's another group of institutions like the one I belong to that are providers of tools and technology. And what the usefulness of companies like ours is about helping seeing what you can't see, helping acting what it's very difficult it's very difficult to have, for example, molecular tweezers. So some of the best discoveries in biology in the last 10 to 20 years are, for example, how to cut the DNA in the middle. Those are what are called restriction enzymes. And cutting and pasting is a tool. But initially, it was a discovery. And last, obviously, but not least, pharma and biotech, who use all this knowledge and develop pharmaceuticals and therapeutic medicine. So in order to make this whole network work, the teamwork and alliances are absolutely essential. And it does work. I want to walk you through the highlights of this slide, which is a big success here. But that success started in 1960 and was completed 20 years later, which is a drug to address a form of leukemia that touches something like 4,600 people every year. 4,600 people are diagnosed with the chronic CML, which is chronic myelogenous leukemia, every year. Now, the fundamental mechanism of this disease was established in 1960. It was attributed to a piece of a chromosome jumping to another chromosome. Later on, more detail was understood, and it was viewed that it was a tyrosine kinase that was responsible for the dysfunction. That tyrosine kinase was turning on a cancer gene. So from that point on, drug research started and tried to find a molecule that blocked the activity of this tyrosine kinase. And the tyrosine kinase is a protein. Well, to make the long story short, today this is a total success story in the sense that 80% of these patients are in complete remission. So, starting from fundamental research, applying the tool to identify where things are, and then developing the molecule that inhibits the activity of this molecule. With this, I'd like to introduce our speakers. You're gonna see three presentations looking at this fundamental research in three different stages. First, starting with well-understood proteins, but not necessarily well-exploited. Then you're gonna have Partho Ghosh, who's going to address targets, proteins that are less understood, and try to see what it takes to understand them a little better. And finally, you're going to see a presentation from Betsy Kamavis, who's going to try to show you how we discover new targets. So with this, I'd like to introduce Professor Seth Cohn, who is a professor of chemistry and biochemistry at UCSD here. Thank you.
Well, thank you all for coming down to San Diego today and listening to us tell you a little bit about how we're contributing to what was just discussed, this idea of drug design and not only designing molecules, but actually finding what targets you want to design molecules towards. So as was just described, I'm going to discuss what would really be the later stage of this story, targets that are already known, proteins we already know play a bad role, a pathogenic role in a disease, and how we're trying to improve the drug design, the last stages. How can we inhibit or stop these proteins from doing what they're doing in a better way? So as was mentioned, my name is Seth Cohen. I'm in the Department of Chemistry, and actually all of your other speakers today are my colleagues, my senior colleagues. We're all in the same department. So the title of my talk, my brief talk is The Chink in the Armor, Taking an Aim at Metals and Enzymes. So I'm not your traditional drug design guy. I'm an inorganic chemist. And so usually, like when I told my parents this, they said, well, what are you doing with cells and proteins? If you're an inorganic chemist, you should be playing with rocks. But there is a field of inorganic chemistry known as bioinorganic chemistry, biological inorganic chemistry. And people usually say, well, what is that? Isn't all biological chemistry organic? Well, of course it isn't. And so let me give you a very one-slide introduction to how metals, inorganic chemistry, play an important role in biological systems, and that's here. So what is the role of a metal in a biological system? Well, it's a protein that's a metalloprotein. Okay, what is a metalloprotein? It's a protein whose function requires a metal ion. So it can't do its job without a metal ion. The most common example, I think the sort of pinnacle example, is hemoglobin, the structure of which is shown here on the left. Hemoglobin, as we all know, its job is to transport oxygen through the blood and take it to different parts of the body. Well, hemoglobin is comprised of four units here, 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 and here. They all look basically the same. And embedded within each of those units, you can see are these groups here. These groups here, which I've then highlighted, that's the heme in hemoglobin. Okay? And in this heme molecule, at the very center, shown in red, is an iron atom. Okay? And it's this iron atom where the oxygen binds to be transported through the blood. So without the iron in the heme, found in the hemoglobin, this protein can't do its job. It can't transport oxygen. So that's your basic idea of why is a metal ion important in a biological system? Why is a metal ion important to a metalloprotein? Well, hemoglobin can't do its job. It can't transport oxygen without iron. Okay, and that's why one of the many reasons why iron is so important to us, say, in our diet. Okay, now I'm not going to talk about hemoglobin. I'm going to talk about a different class of proteins called proteases. Proteases are a class of proteins whose job it is to cut up other proteins. Okay, so they're sort of like molecular scissors. They chop up other proteins. And so this very, very simplified scheme here shows you what a protease will do. So the protease is represented by this Pac-Man type figure, and it will come along and find its substrate, find its molecule it's going to act on, and it will chop it up. And it might chop it up into two pieces or three pieces or many, many small pieces. Depends on the protease. Okay? So what we are interested in as inorganic chemists are metal-containing proteases. So what happens when you take a metalloprotein and combine it with a protease? You get a metalloprotease. Okay? Not that complicated. And a metalloprotease is just a protease that has, represented by the green sphere here, a metal ion at the roof of that mouth. Okay? And it's this metal ion that acts as the teeth to cut up this peptide or cut up this other protein. Okay? And so what I'm going to tell you about over the course of the next few slides is that many metalloproteases are actually heavily, strongly implicated in a wide range of diseases. That is, they're chopping up proteins and peptides they ought not to be doing, and therefore propagating a disease. And so from my perspective as an inorganic chemist, we want to know, and this is what the field has generally done, is how can we design a drug that will block the mouth of this protease, right, and then stop it from doing its job so that it can't destroy this other protein that apparently would be essential, okay? So to stop the progression of this disease by this type of mechanism. So that's what we're looking at, and we want to look at how can we improve this drug represented by the red triangle to block that mouth and shut it down and thereby develop a therapeutic. So I'm going to show you three targets that we've been working on in my lab over the last couple of years, and that you'll see there's a commonality that inspired us to work on this problem. So here's one of these metalloproteases. It's specifically called matrix metalloprotease, or MMP. The structure is shown here, and you can see that I've highlighted in the cleft of this sort of mouth of this protease is a metal, okay, the green sphere. And in this case, it's zinc. Okay, it's a zinc ion, a zinc atom. And so here's the structure of the protein, and MMPs are important because they've been implicated, again, in a wide range of diseases. I highlight specifically heart disease because here at UC San Diego, my chemistry lab has worked with a cardiology lab in the School of Medicine looking at MMPs, but they've actually been studied for at least 20 years for things like cancer and arthritis as well. Okay? So they're very important targets to shut down their activity, to stop them chopping up other proteins to treat these diseases. So how have people done this? Well, here's the structure of the same protein, but with a drug bound. And the drug is shown in red. Okay? And you can see that the drug is bound right in the cleft of the mouth. Okay? Not only that, it's binding directly to the zinc. Okay? Now that's very important because this drug can bind anywhere on this protein. And as long as it disrupts this protein somehow, such that it can't cut those other proteins, then it's a perfectly good drug. But generally, what has been done is that the drug directly goes to the active site. It directly goes to the zinc. It doesn't bind somewhere else. Okay? This commonality you'll find over and over again. Here's another class of protease-like enzymes called the histone deacetylases, or HDACs. You can see here's the structure, very different in structure from the MMP. But again, in this cleft or in this mouth of the Pac-Man, there's a metal ion. It's again a zinc. Okay? And again, if the HIDACs have become very, very important targets in the last couple of years for the HDACs for cancer therapeutics. And if we look at the inhibited form of the enzyme, so with a drug bound, again, the drug shown in red, you can see this could have bound anywhere on the protein and disrupted its function, but it didn't. It it binds directly to the zinc in the mouth. Okay. Finally, we can look at anthrax lethal factor. The importance of this protein, shown here again on the left, in human health and disease is probably self-explanatory. The anthrax lethal factor is a protease that is a toxin produced by anthrax that kills your cells and kills you, ultimately. It's considered one of the prime targets for trying to stop anthrax. You can see here, again, the structure of protein, different from the MMPs, different from the HIDAC, or the HDAC. But again, in the mouth, there's a zinc ion, a zinc atom found. And if we look at the early stages, how people have been trying to develop drugs to stop anthrax and anthrax lethal factor, again, the red drug is bound directly to the zinc. And so in all three cases, right, binding to the metal is critical for the activity of these drugs to really shut down these detrimental enzymes, these detrimental proteins effectively. So that, as an inorganic chemist, was a very intriguing problem because the metal is a key component of this drug design. So let's look at how these drugs, these red molecules I've been showing you binding to the zinc, what they look like and how they're designed, and then how we played a role or are trying to play a role. So not being someone with a medicinal chemistry background or a drug design chemistry background, I tried to look at these molecules and say, well, what is the common theme? And they have a very common theme that there's an easy analogy one can draw to, say, a guided missile, right? So a guided missile is designed to take out a target, just like these drugs are designed to take out a target, this protein of interest, the MMP or the HDAC or whatever. So the missile's got two parts, right? You have to have the bomb, the warhead, to stop the target, to blow it up or whatever, okay? But then you need a guidance system, right? Something to direct it to the target, right? Whatever that target may be. So here are the chemical structures of the three drugs that were highlighted in red earlier for each of those proteins. Here's the MMP drug. The little I just stands for inhibitor. Okay, so the MMP inhibitor, the HDAC inhibitor, and the lethal factor inhibitor. So these are the three drugs. Very different in chemical structure, right? You can see they're clearly different. So what's the commonality or what's the strategy? Well, the parts shown in black are the guidance system, okay? And you can see they're really different because they target three different proteins, right? So the MMP inhibitor has this guidance system, which should take the drug to the MMP. Same here to take it to the HDAC and here to take it to the lethal factor. But as you might notice, the warhead highlighted in red for all of these compounds is the same. So these missiles, these drugs are carrying the same payload to stop these enzymes, but their guidance systems is the only thing that's different, okay, which makes sense. But as an inorganic chemist, this group here, which is called the hydroxamic acid, highlighted in red, this warhead, was what we were interested in. Is this really, this is the part, this warhead is the part that's binding the zinc. That's why it's kept the same, okay? That's why it's the warhead. So our question was, is this really the best group you could use to bind that zinc, to bind it most tightly, to have the most powerful bomb at the end of this war, at end of this missile? And this, we felt, was an important problem because here again I show you a variety of chemical structures. These are actually all different MMPIs, all different inhibitors of MMPs. And you can see that they have a whole wide range of guidance systems to take them to these drug targets or these protein targets. But they all carry that hydroxamic acid payload, okay, over and over and over again. And so we thought if we could actually come up with an alternative warhead, because this really hadn't been explored, you can see that in general in the pharmaceutical industry and in other aspects of research, the guidance systems had been well finely tuned. But the warheads really had been sort of, well, this works, we're going to stick with it, it binds the zinc, that's good enough. And we thought, well, maybe we could do better. Maybe we could find a more powerful warhead, something that binds the zinc more tightly that would make a more potent drug and might have other benefits as well. And so that was the focus of our group as a inorganic chemist. Can we bind the zinc more tightly and thereby create a better drug? So to really simplify this to the greatest extent, but I hope this will just stimulate discussion. I'm not really giving you the nitty-gritty of our research, but giving you the overall idea. This is that hydroxamic acid group, the warhead used in most of these systems. So based on really a variety of factors, but one, just looking what kind of molecules are already available in the food industry, in the cosmetics industry, in the pharmaceutical industry, that might actually be better warheads. And so looking at things as simple as cotton candy contains a molecule called maltol. It's that molecule there. That's what actually gives cotton candy that funny smell, that sort of characteristic smell. This molecule inhibits MMPs, HDACs, and lethal factor better than the hydroxamic acid. And it's an FDA-approved food additive. Okay? Then we take it up a notch and we look at anti-dandruff shampoos. Anti-dandruff shampoos have a compound, the active ingredient is a compound called zinc pyrithione. What is pyrithione? Pyrithione is this molecule. This molecule inhibits MMP's lethal factor better both than maltol and hydroxamic acid. As a matter of fact, the difference between the hydroxamic acid and this commercially used FDA-approved chemical additive for shampoos is over 700-fold better. So it's significantly better. And on top of it, why look at these things that are already in industry? Well, of course, the obvious answer is we want to think about drugs. We want to think about molecules that are going to be non-toxic, right? FDA-approved food additive. And yes, we don't eat Head and Shoulders, but we're not dropping dead in the shower either, so it shouldn't be acutely toxic. So these are good starting points for thinking about warheads that are not going to be toxic and can be used in drug design. Okay? So hopefully that gives you an overview of how an inorganic chemist sort of morphed himself into the pharmaceutical industry a little bit, or medicinal chemistry at the very least. I feel it's always important to acknowledge those that did the work. This is a slightly dated picture of my research group, but the names highlighted in red are the students that contributed to this project, and I owe them a great debt. David Puerta, who will graduate in January, Faith Jacobson, Jana Lewis, Ba Tran, an undergraduate, and Jay Stork, who's not pictured, a new postdoc in my lab. So I thank them for all their hard work and all of the students depicted here and named. And finally, I have to acknowledge collaborators. This is my cardiology collaborator, Professor Francisco Villarreal, Professor Andy McCammon, also in our department, Professor Arnold Weinogold in our department, and of course, none of this is possible without sufficient funding, and most of this project has been funded by the university here and the American Heart Association. So let me now introduce the next speaker, my colleague Partho Ghosh. Okay, thank you.
So it's a great pleasure to be here to tell you about some of the work my lab is doing. And what we're focused in understanding is how do pathogens, in particular bacterial pathogens, interact with hosts to cause disease. And what we'd like to do is understand these interactions at a molecular level. Because at heart, what happens is that a pathogen interacts and influences its host using its molecules, which are generally termed virulence factors, because without them, the pathogen is non-virulent, doesn't cause disease. And these factors, generally proteins, have targets in host cells. And by modifying those targets, and again, mostly proteins, what a successful pathogen does through these kinds of interactions is a number of things. And one of the most important things is to, first of all, find a place in a host to live, the proper place. For example, respiratory pathogens have to get to the lung, enteric pathogens have to get to your intestines. So they establish a niche. The second thing they have to do is avoid all the great ways, immune system, that we have of killing the pathogen. Then they have to make lots more copies of themselves. They proliferate in various organs and then are finally transmitted to other hosts. So you get an infectious disease that spreads throughout a population, and any good pathogen is one that's able to transmit itself to huge numbers of people. Now, so we wanted to understand how these kinds of features work by understanding the molecules that are produced. And today, I'll tell you a short story about one of these systems. And this is a system that has got a very non-evocative name called a type 3 secretion system. But the most interesting thing about this system is that there are a large number of bacteria, and I'll tell you in a second which ones, have needles on their surfaces. Basically, that function just like syringes do. So these are molecular syringes, and this is depicted in an EM micrograph from Jorge Galán's lab. These needles sit on the surface of the bacterium. And what these needles do is essentially when they come up to your cell, for example, they inject a certain number of proteins, very special proteins, directly from their cytosol, their interior, right into your interior. And these proteins are designed to do different things. So different bacteria make different proteins that go in and start affecting the human cell and are important for disease causation. Now, these needles, these macromolecular needles, are conserved in a huge number of gram-negative pathogens. So these are bacteria like E. coli that you find in tainted food that will cause very severe disease. I'll tell you today about some work we've been doing with Pseudomonas. They're also found in a large number of other foodborne bacteria like Salmonella and Shigella and so on. Interestingly, this system has been conserved through evolution, so not only do you get pathogens of animals that have these needles, but also pathogens of plants. So plants are, in fact, affected by these needle-containing bacteria. So today I'll give you an example of what we do in trying to understand how to stop bacteria that inject proteins into human cells. And I'll focus today on understanding a problem in a bacterium called Pseudomonas. So Pseudomonas, shown here in an EM image again, is a gram-negative rod. It's pretty ubiquitous. It's in the soil everywhere, and we probably actually have some Pseudomonas on our bodies right now. Pseudomonas, what makes Pseudomonas especially dangerous is it's generally antibiotic resistant. It has natural mechanisms of avoiding most antibiotics. Now, our immune systems usually deal with Pseudomonas very well. The problem is for patients who have weakened immune systems. So, for example, patients undergoing cancer therapy, patients who have another kind of illness are now weakened in their immune system, burn victims as well. Now, what we noticed was in the literature that there were strains of Pseudomonas that cause severe and acute infections. Most strains cause chronic, long-term, mild infections, still not good. But there are strains that basically kill people in a day to two. So these strains that are severe and acute, what we also noticed in the literature, that almost all of them produce this protein called XOU, which is injected into the human cell. And what we knew at that time is when that protein's injected, the human cell dies. But we didn't know why. So that's what we thought we'd try to understand. A student in my lab, Rebecca Phillips, asked, how does XOU kill human cells? And if we could figure that out, can we stop it? So how do you go about solving that problem? One thing we like to do in our lab is try to figure out what a protein looks like in three dimensions, where all the atoms are. Well, that didn't work. But the power of modern biology and genomics has led us to, I think, a pretty interesting answer. So what Rebecca started to do was look at XOU sequence. This is just depicted. It's a protein of about 700 amino acids. And she started looking, using, in a sense, a genomic tool, at all kinds of other sequences and asked, what's this protein like? Well, the answer was it's not like much anything else. But once in a while, using a tool called CyBlast, which is freely available, she starts noticing there were some similarities in very small regions. We call these 1 and 2. And that these regions seem to be similar to a class of enzymes called phospholipases. And what do phospholipases do? They can degrade the sort of the greasy outer coat of cells, the membranes. So they can take those and break them apart. And it's been well known that snake venom toxins are often phospholipases. And they can just essentially degrade the outside of a cell, so the cell essentially disintegrates. So this made some sense. But we also realized when we did this that we had to be pretty skeptical because most of this protein, except for these two colored boxes, don't look anything like a phospholipase. So how do you test that idea? Well, the way Rebecca went about doing it is to make some XOU recombinantly. And when we did that, we added it to the outside of mammalian cells, and nothing happened. Completely inert. The cells are very happy. But we, of course, knew that's not what the bacterium does. It injects the protein into the host cell. So we had to find a way to do that. And Rebecca came out with basically a macro version of a needle, a real syringe. And she was able to take a syringe, essentially, and put a lot of mammalian cells in the syringe in XOU. And through a technique called syringe loading, she was able to get the protein into the cell and basically ask now, what happens? What does the protein do when it's in this mammalian cell? And what she found was that the protein kills the cell. So what you're looking at is cell death. So Rebecca could look at these cells either visually or ask, basically, would they essentially explode? And this is showing that when you get XOU into a cell, it essentially kills the cell, explodes the cell. But whenever she made a mutation or changed either residues in this first part or the second part, the protein was now completely inert. So that was consistent with what we found, that this is probably a phospholipase. And the other experiments that really led us to believe that it's a phospholipase. Now, we also compared, and I won't show you, we compared this amount of killing with what happens with a snake venom phospholipase. So she could take a snake venom toxin and put it into cells and ask, how well does it kill? And it turns out XUU is a much more potent enzyme than the snake venom toxin. So this is an amazingly powerful protein. But that brought up a real problem, because this protein is sitting in the bacteria. Why didn't it kill the bacteria? How can you carry around this incredibly destructive protein? And what we realized was that it interacts with something in human cells. So this shows a fluorescence image where Rebecca put XUU that had gotten basically a fluorescent tag, green fluorescent protein, and when she injected into cells, instead of seeing the protein go everywhere, she saw it go to particular places. And we still don't understand what this is all about, but we think it's interacting with specific host components. And those host components are required to turn this enzyme on, essentially. So in the bacterium, it's completely happy but inactive. When it gets into the host cell, it meets a partner, and it becomes this very destructive enzyme. So we're still trying to figure out what that is, but going back to something that Claude said, one of the powerful ways of doing this now in modern biology is to use other organisms. So what we discovered was that XUU function was conserved from yeast to man, and that, in fact, if you took yeast and expressed XUU, it killed all the yeast. So this shows, basically, there are no yeast on this plate. They're all dead because they're making XUU. Whereas if there's an inactive form of XUU, the yeast are perfectly happy and live. So now what we can do is, taking advantage of all that great information on yeast, start asking, what is it in yeast that allows XUU to kill? And once we figure that out, try to relate that back to mammalian cells. But the last part I want to tell you about, so we don't know what the answer is in that part yet, and I think we're discovering some very interesting things, but that story's not completed. But the other thing we realize is when we realize it was a phospholipase is to ask, can we throw inhibitors of phospholipases, so there were well-known inhibitors of phospholipases, and block the cell killing? And so Rebecca, again, did the same experiment where she loaded protein XUU into cells, and as before, if we add nothing, no inhibitor, the cells die. But importantly, when we added two different chemical inhibitors of phospholipases, we protect the cell. And so this immediately led to a new question. Now, we had done this experiment in a very artificial way, using macro syringes and so on. Let's go back to the bacterial situation. And so we went back and looked at an infection model where we take mammalian cells and add Pseudomonas and basically ask, can we protect these cells with these inhibitors? And those data are shown in the following slide. So if we take Pseudomonas, a clinical strain, and add it to these cells, as expected, the cells, the human cells, die. If we take artificial strain where we knocked out XUU, we see that the cells live. So all this killing is, again, due to XUU. The important experiment then is taking the clinical strain and adding the inhibitors, and we essentially protect all of them. So by using this phospholipase inhibitor, we've knocked out the ability of XUU to kill these cells. Now, the story doesn't end there, because phospholipase, it's a general family of enzymes, are also found in all of us, and they do important things. They, in fact, modulate our immune system. So we know in the clinic we'd never want to do this experiment, really. What we need to find now are inhibitors that go to XUU specifically and don't touch our phospholipases. And going back to the fact that XUU is very different from mammalian phospholipases makes us think we can do that. They're only about 10% identical. So now we want to figure out what they look like, and as Seth was saying, trying to find inhibitors that specifically block this enzyme, and that could become a therapeutic for people who are suffering from acute and severe pneumonias caused by Pseudomonas that would kill them. And again, the most important side, this work was done almost all by a very talented graduate student, Rebecca Phillips, working with several people at UCSD, including David Six and Ed Dennis's lab. We're helped in the yeast work by Lorraine Pillis, and now looking at some new molecules, Bill Fenichel has been instrumental, and we've also been doing work on the yeast system with Charlie Boone at the University of Toronto. And I will stop there and pass on the baton to, or the computer to, Dr. Betsy Kalmaves.
So for this last presentation today, I'd like to tell you about a few tools that we are trying to develop in my lab for studying this battlefront of protein-protein interactions up close. And just to reiterate a little bit, the very first step that you have to accomplish if you want to study a potential drug target is to figure out what that protein is interacting with in the cell. And as Claude was saying at the beginning, we now have the whole sequence of the whole human genome. And we can translate that sequence into proteins. So we know, in theory, what all the proteins are that might be in every one of the cells in our bodies. But the tricky part is that not all the cells in our bodies make all the proteins. In fact, they only make about a quarter to a third of all the proteins in our genes. All of them make different subsets of these proteins. And there's also more complicated factors, such as the fact that sometimes you can get more than one protein per gene, because you can have different splicing of the gene and different than translation of that gene. And then on top of that, proteins can be modified. They can have covalent linkages of other groups on their amino acids. And that really complicates the situation. You can put phosphates on serines and threonines and tyrosines, and you can put acetyl groups and methyl groups and all kinds of different stuff on the proteins. And every one of those new chemical bonds makes that protein function differently. So we have an incredibly complicated array of proteins in each of the cells in our bodies. And that doesn't even start to address the question of now who are they interacting with. But this whole study, I should say, of what proteins are there in each of the cells in our bodies is called proteomics. And it's a very new science that's starting to be done in a lot of different labs with more or less success. So in my lab, we do proteomics and other kinds of mass spec experiments that I'm going to tell you about today using a MALDI mass spectrometer. And MALDI stands for matrix-assisted laser desorption ionization, but you don't have to remember that. But I got this little animation from my colleague, Kim Prather, who also does MALDI mass spectrometry. And I wanted to show it to you so you can see what happens inside this mass spectrometer. So inside the mass spectrometer, we place a sample that's a mixture of proteins. And we put it on this thing called the target, and we put it with some matrix that's going to assist it. And the object of the game is, in the end of the experiment, we want to be able to measure the weights of each of those proteins that are in this sample. And so the way the MALDI mass spectrometer works is, let's shown in this little animation. A laser comes and hits, and the sample blows off the target and flies down this tube called a time of flight tube. I'm going to try this again so you can see it again. And the trick is that the time that it takes each of those proteins to fly down the tube depends on how much they weigh. So watch this one more time here. And you'll see that there are blue ones and green ones and red ones. And the blue ones weigh less and they get there first. There's the weight of the blue ones and then the green ones and then the red ones. So that's how this mass spectrometer works. It's actually a very simple design and it works beautifully. There are lots of different kinds of mass spectrometers, and I just threw this slide up so you would see some of the terms. There's ES, which stands for electrospray, and the one I told you about is time of flight. There are also other kinds of analysis tools that are available, like Fourier transform, magnetic sector. But all of these things do the same thing. You put a sample inside, and you want to measure the weights of all the proteins that come out at the other end. So there's two kinds of proteomics experiments that can be done. And there are advantages and disadvantages to both, and I just wanted to introduce them today so you could get a feel for how these targets are being identified. So if you already know a protein that you think is interesting, the proteomics people call this the bait, and you essentially go fishing. with that bait. You take some cells and you grind them all up, and you have your bait protein attached to some kind of a fish hook, and you fish in your cells, lysates, and you say, who does my bait want to stick to? And you pull those sticky proteins out. And then you can just run this whole thing on a gel, and you do the control experiment where you have just the bait with no cell lysate. Here's my bait coming out on a gel that measures the weights of the proteins by size. And then here's the one that that I fished with, and you can see that I get other proteins in my gel, and they're the ones that stuck to my bait. And I can actually cut these little bits of protein out of this gel and put them on that target in the mass spectrometer and fly them through there and see what they are. Identify them. The other type of proteomics experiment that lots of labs are doing, with I would say much less success than the fish and bait type of experiment, is called cellular proteomics. And here is when you have really no idea what you're looking for. But what you know is that you have cells that are in one state and cells that are in another state. And usually people do this, for example, that they have regular breast tissue cells and cancerous breast tissue cells, for example. Okay? And then you just grind up the whole cells and you say, okay, now if I run out all these proteins, here you need two-dimensional gels and lots of mass spectrometer time, but it's the exact same experiment. Now you're looking for what are all the cells in this, what are all the proteins in this cell, and what are all the proteins in this cell, and can I see any differences? And I hope you see this one here. Here's a red little cross-shaped protein that was in the cancerous cell and not in the healthy breast cell. And then you say, aha, you know, maybe that's a good target because that cancer cell was making that protein and the healthy cell is not. So that's what cellular proteomics is about. And all of it depends on our ability to take tiny little bits of protein and put them in that mass spectrometer and measure their weights. So this is where we are right now with the human interactome. This was done by fishing in human cells with 500 different baits. And you can't see much because this is plastered. One of my friends said, this is the roadkill model. They take a three-dimensional interactome and they plaster it onto the screen for you. So it gets very dense in the middle. But you can see that there are proteins even on the edges here. This guy is interacting with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different proteins directly. And many proteins inside of our cells interact with lots of different proteins. And sometimes it depends. They'll interact with this one if they have a phosphate group in one position. They'll interact with this one if their phosphate group is in another position, and they'll interact with this one when they don't have any phosphates on, and it's really complicated. So we're just at the beginning of starting to dig out, you know, who interacts with who and when. So I just wanted to show you a little bit of results from our lab going in this direction. We're working on this protein called LRP1, which is implicated in Alzheimer's disease. And we went fishing with a little piece of LRP1, and we found all these different proteins that interacted with this LRP1. And this is actually a really, really interesting result, because when we went through and looked at who all these proteins are, many of them are proteins that actually put phosphates on other proteins. And this is what happens in your neurons when you have Alzheimer's disease. You have a protein called tau that gets too many phosphate groups put on it, and that forms tangles inside your neurons, and then the neurons die. So we're really excited about this result, actually, because there are things that go on in Alzheimer's disease that you've probably heard about that go on outside of the neurons. That's where you have these fibrils and the amyloid and all that. But no one ever understood how what's going on outside the cells is influencing what's going on inside the cells. And so this result strongly suggests that it's LRP1 that connects those amyloids that it binds to outside the cells and then the phosphorylation that occurs inside the cells. So then shifting gears, I wanted to tell you a little bit about the work that we're doing in heart disease, which we've actually been doing for a while, longer than the Alzheimer's disease, so we've made a little more progress here. And I don't know if you realize, everyone thinks that heart disease is caused by cholesterol, but really heart disease is caused by the fact that when you have little tiny smears of cholesterol inside your blood vessels, your blood thinks that that's a wound, and it tries to make a clot on top of that, just like you would make a scab when you got a cut. And it's actually that clot, that scab, that blocks the blood vessel. And that's why heart attacks happen just like a, you don't know when they're going to happen, because you always have that little bit of cholesterol in there, but all of a sudden and unpredictably, your blood decides, oh my gosh, that's a wound, I better put a clot there, and boom, you've blocked the blood vessel, and that's when you have a heart attack. So we were interested in the interaction of these two proteins in this whole complicated blood clotting cascade, because this protein, thrombin, is the one that actually is responsible for making the clot out of fibrinogen. And thrombomodulin is the protein that stops thrombin from making that clot. So we thought if we could understand how thrombomodulin works, then maybe we could make drugs that mimicked thrombomodulin that could keep people from clotting. So this is that interaction then a little bit closer, and it's interesting to think about the fact that this interaction occurs in your flowing blood. And so what happens is thrombomodulin is actually tethered to the blood vessel endothelium, and thrombomodulin is flowing along through the blood. And so thrombomodulin actually has to reach out and capture thrombin from the flowing blood, which is what it does. And when thrombomodulin captures thrombin, it changes its activity. And so now it has anticoagulant activity. So when we realized that this interaction was occurring in the flowing blood, we decided to use a specific tool to study it, and that tool is called surface plasmon resonance, and it's a way of measuring binding kinetics in real time. And so I don't know if you can recognize that this is now inside the surface plasmon resonance spectrometer, that we tether thrombomodulin to a gold surface, and we flow thrombin through the flow cell, and we detect using a white light beam bouncing off of a prism and the plasmon that runs through the gold. We don't have to worry too much about the details. We can detect in real time how thrombin interacts with thrombomodulin, and we can watch it. We can watch it in real time associate with the thrombomodulin and then reach a flowing equilibrium, and then we can inject buffer and watch the dissociation of these two proteins as the buffer is injected. And what we get out of this experiment is actually how fast do these proteins come together and how fast do they come apart. And we made a really interesting discovery doing these experiments, because everyone always thought that all protein-protein interactions happened the same way that antibodies interact with proteins. And so we did the experiment of comparing thrombomodulin binding to thrombin with an antibody binding to thrombin. And it's really fascinating because the antibody binds to thrombin at the same site that thrombomodulin binds to thrombin. But look at how different the kinetics are. Thrombomodulin binds to thrombin very fast, and then it comes off very fast. The antibody binds to thrombin very slowly, and then it's stuck there. It almost doesn't come off at all. And it's fascinating because these two interactions have exactly the same binding affinity. So if all you were measuring was the binding affinity, you would think these interactions were exactly the same. But in terms of drug design, you have to understand that this interaction is rapidly going on and off, whereas this interaction, once it sticks, it's stuck there. You can flow whatever past it, and it's going to be stuck there. So the other type of experiment that we actually developed ourselves in my own lab is something that we call MALDI mapping. And here, what we're trying to do is see what's the spot on each of these two proteins where they stick to each other. And in order to see that, what we do is we take, actually just focus on this part down here because that's the part where the interaction is happening. We take each of the proteins that we think interact with each other and we soak them in heavy water. And these Ds represent deuterium, which was discovered by Harold Urey, who was one of the founding members of our chemistry department here at UCSD. So I think it's kind of wonderful that we've exploited some of his discoveries in our later work. If you soak these proteins in heavy water, their surfaces will take on those heavy hydrogen atoms or heavy hydrogen atoms. And so they'll become labeled with D. And if you think back, we know we can measure the weights of proteins using mass spectrometry. So if they've gotten heavy water on them, they're going to weigh more. And so here's what we do. We soak each of the proteins with heavy water, in heavy water, and then we bind them to each other, and then we wash off the heavy water. And so now what happens is that all the heavy water washes off, except for the spots in the proteins where they interact with each other, because those can't get washed anymore. They're stuck to each other. And then we cut the proteins up in little pieces, and we measure how much each of the little pieces weigh, and we put the little pieces back together in the whole protein, and we can see where they were stuck to each other. It's a very simple experiment, actually. And so this is a movie. What we discovered was that these two red surface loops here are where thrombomodulin sticks to thrombin. But kind of, I think, even more exciting, we could see using this heavy water experiment what thrombomodulin was doing to thrombin. Because it not only sticks to it, it tugs on a strand of it, this pink strand here. And when it tugs on that pink strand, it changes this loop that's right at the active site. Seth already introduced proteases, and thrombin is also a protease. And this white molecule here is a substrate mimic of thrombin. And you can see that thrombin does kind of look like a Pac-Man with a mouth here. It's not a metalloproteinase, but it still has that same kind of a mouth that chews up proteins. And it does a very specific clip of fibrinogen to make the fibrin clot. And this is the active site here. And so not only were we able to see where the thrombomodulin binds, but we were able to map exactly what it's doing to change the activity of thrombin. So this turns around, and you can see that the thrombomodulin binding site's on the other side of the molecule from the active site, way far away. Let me do it again. There we go. And that it runs clear around to the active site. Let me do it one more time. There we go. Okay. So we're learning a lot about what proteins do when they interact with each other and how there's changes that are propagated through them when they interact with each other. So here's just a few conclusions. Mass spectrometry is very useful for finding the protein-protein interaction binding partners, and our lab is using that to find new targets for Alzheimer's disease. We've developed this MALDI mapping experiment that helps us find the binding sites, but it also helps us find activity changes in proteins that are induced when one partner binds to another. And this is just my group that actually everyone contributed to all the experiments in here. Mike and Gina are the two that did the Alzheimer's experiments, and Munira and Julia are the two that did a lot of the thrombin experiments, and Matthew and Stephanie and Elena did a lot of the thrombin experiments too, and Matthew and Stephanie are working on the MALDI mapping. So thank you.